I had just sold a company and I was figuring out what to do next. Bill calls me like a couple of weeks afterwards and he's like, I was wondering if you could go see this company. They're looking for a new exec. Thought you might be a good fit. Go have a chat. And I was like, I don't know. Let me think about it. It's not for me. I wouldn't use it. It was Facebook. And it was Zuck.
Wait, what?
With three successful Silicon Valley exits worth over $130 million, Ike Eze is one of the sharpest minds in Africa venture capital, leading Beta Ventures with offices in Lagos and New York.
What do you tell a founder who's passionate about their idea but is not the right fit to lead it?
In my 20s, when I was a lot younger, I was just, your idea sucks and you suck. But if you got a better person, maybe the idea could work, but it's not you. And then the person would essentially retrench back into their shell. But now we try to just evaluate and see if we can be more additive. So if we think that you are not the right person, the first question we have to ask ourselves is...
He mastered the art of scaling businesses at the highest level. And for years, he applied that expertise here on the continent, backing founders, building Africa's future.
Because we as VCs, we don't play when it's apparent. It's too late. You have to play on significantly early signals. We create a thesis about sectors that we're interested in, and we delve into those sectors, and what we're watching for are in those sectors.
If someone was to offer you $200 million to leave Africa tech market and go back to Silicon Valley, would you do it?
When does the wire clear?
In this episode, he shares why Africa doesn't need more copycat startups, how to tell the difference between a business owner and a true entrepreneur, and why building with the exit in mind isn't selling out, it's wealth creation.
How important would you say self-awareness is, especially when you're evaluating a founder and maybe the startup they're pitching you?
On this podcast, people may be on the way to work, they may be working out, maybe it's been a long day, and they come home and listen to your episode. And I want you to tell our audience what is one thing they should understand about the investment opportunity in Africa.
I think you have to look at the parallels. And the parallels with markets that have gone through the same things that we've gone through. So if you look at China, India, Brazil, and tech has led that wave. And what you find is that there's a sequence that happens. There's interest. There are people that are usually from the West, emerging markets, that are coming back to the emerging markets. And it starts out a little slow. But then you start to see signs. And usually the first signs of that a market is exciting is that you can mint a unicorn. Someone believes that there is a billion-dollar company that has been minted. But with time, you start seeing the frequency of the unicorns emerging. So it's not one every 5 years. It's one every 2 years. Then suddenly one a year. What we are seeing in Nigeria, if you think about MoneyPoint, Opay, PalmPay, these are three companies that are unicorns, all in the same space. So it isn't a spectrum of spaces. It's a singular space that has minted three unicorns in the last 3 to 4 years. So that's what I would say is that the signs initially, that's like a patter. But once the torrential storm comes, it usually already has players in place that have weathered the early rains and are now enjoying sort of the floods.
Okay, so it's so interesting you say this because randomly yesterday I saw a announcement saying that for the first time, the digital economy in Nigeria has actually gone further ahead than the oil economy, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm curious if we now look into Nigeria and the tech sector. I've known you for a long time, so we've seen the variations of the Nigerian tech scene. Talk about, you know, the early days when you moved back till like now. What have you seen so far?
So a couple of things. Well, let's say a few things, not two or three. The first is that the check sizes have changed. Back when we started investing, you could write a $5,000 check. And in some cases, you could get decent like points on the board. So you could pick up 2, 3, 4, 5% of a company. So the check sizes have changed. So your entry point now to get maybe 1% of a company is you're writing a check of $50,000, $100,000 at the earlier stage. Two, the quality of companies have changed. So you'll find that before, people used to just have ideas of, I remember someone came to me and said, I'm doing the Twitter of Africa. And I was like, Twitter is the Twitter of Africa. That you can't out-Twitter Twitter. But he was really focused on just the tech, not the distribution, the usage, and all those things. So people are thinking a little bit more deeply about the solutions that they have. Third thing is that you now have people that have been burnt in the first cycle of startups. Maybe they've been burnt in the second cycle. So they have a little bit more experience, and they understand a lot more. So entrepreneurs that we would be giving advice to maybe 10 years ago, it's like, what do you know? That I'm going my own way. Nowadays, entrepreneurs actually are taking the time to listen and realizing it's not just the idea itself. And I also think the ecosystem is developing along with it. Sometimes the ecosystem is not developing as fast as we would like it to. Because if you think about a startup comes in, there's the idea, there's the engineering, but then you need the ecosystem of marketers, biz dev, legal, accounting. You also need the ecosystem of the, essentially the government side that regulate the industry to be moving at the same speed as that sector is moving. So we are seeing those things have emerged and are emerging. That's a big change. It's that the ecosystem is developing a lot more. I will say that one of the things that is still needing to move maybe a little faster is seeing how we re-energize a new cadre of angel investors. Because the angel investors that were burnt from cycle one...
You haven't come back.
Coming back is hard. Coming back, because you can count the 20 companies you invested in, and when you ask them, how did they go? It's almost like PTSD. They're like, I don't want to talk about it. Let's move on. So I think with these new exits, new secondaries, and so on, that you find that people that are putting money in their pocket that came from startup are now reinjecting some of that capital into the early stage companies that are emerging.
Okay, you've had three successful Silicon Valley exits totaling over $130 million. And now you're building beta ventures in Africa. When you look at the diaspora's relationship with the continent, do you think we're in an extraction phase or a reinvestment phase? And what drives someone to choose reinvestment when extraction is easier?
You know, the diaspora and Nigeria have had a very interesting relationship. People are accustomed to certain types of businesses here. And if you talk to most people offshore that are sending money home, it's usually not for startups. It's not for tech. It's for real estate. It's for, I need to send money to my cousins or my brother's son for school. So it makes so much sense to take a boatload of USD, convert it to Naira, park it, and get income, like income stream, like fixed income. So you're getting 20%+ return. So for deploying, let's say $10 million Naira into an account, you're getting 2 million, 2.5 million in yield. That is a safe instrument to them. Once you start talking about technology, it's the most interesting thing is that the person thinks about technology in the US and they're comfortable with it because they see it. And then they think about technology in Nigeria and there's a reservation. And I think the reservation is around sort of the maturity of the capital markets. And do you have proven exits? Can I see my money back? Are the valuations there? Governance, is it in place? Are these companies actually using the money for what I thought they would use it for? So there's a reticence that exists or a reservation that exists. Over time, we are seeing people start with just a little and then they move into more and they see how that money is doing. So I think we're still in the reinvestment phase. So people are investing slowly. And I think the new angels are going to be a combination of people that are offshore as well as people that are on ground. But I don't think people have started extracting. There's not a lot to extract quite yet. We've had a few exits. I think what we're going to be looking at and what has started to emerge is there is a reset in terms of what an exit could be. So you will find that an entrepreneur goes in, and I wrote something in LinkedIn about this, is the stages of investment. So let's say you go in, you raise money, but you didn't do it from a VC. And the VC didn't have the expectation of 10, 50x on the money. So you do it local, Naira-based, 10, 20 million Naira. And the person says, if I can get back 1x on top of my money, fantastic. So it gives the entrepreneur more exit options. And that's what we are seeing now, is people are selling a company for like 3 million. 3 million is almost 5 billion Naira. That is life-changing for someone. Whereas before, if you'd gone the VC route, that company would have to exit at 50 to 100. And most people wouldn't be able to reach that.
Okay, you recently released the book Founders Fit. And in Founders Fit, you talk about avoiding shiny object syndrome. Yet you have said Africa doesn't need any more payment startups when fintech gets the most funding. How do you help founders distinguish between what's trendy versus what actually fits their strengths and market needs?
So I will clarify one thing first before answering that. I'd say that maybe my article that Africa doesn't need payment startup, a little bit misconstrued by folks. We don't need the volume of payment startups. We need payment startups that are solving needs. And this ties into the fit, that the way we help entrepreneurs is we listen. We actually listen to what they're building. And then we ask questions. Now, the problem sometimes is that people don't like being probed because you want to probe and figure out where is the value that you're adding, what's differentiated, what makes you uniquely qualified to deliver this value. And I think most entrepreneurs, as you probe them, you'll find the domain knowledge might not be there. The ability to differentiate themselves from the other five people in the market might not be there. But once you delve a little bit deeper, you'll find out that it is the shiny object, as in fintechs are getting funded. Let me figure out how to do a fintech. Maybe your sector fit is really ag. You came from farming, you've done agro, you have a tech background, and there's something amazing that you're thinking of. I'm not going to say his name because I'm not going to out him. But we were having a conversation recently with the senior manager at a fintech, at a financial services company, a major financial services company. And he said, oh, I'm thinking of leaving, that there's a startup I'm working on and it does this. And we're like, okay, that's cool. That's nice. Tell us more. And he goes, oh, he describes it. Then we turn around and we're like, oh, so is there anything else you're on? He goes, oh, I have this really stupid idea. And I was like, tell me, let's hear it. So he tells us his silly idea. The silly idea is more exciting than the core idea. And he thought it was silly because the things that he thought about were things that were embedded in the industry that only he knew, or the people in the industry knew. And he had come up with a way to do this unique thing. It was innovative. It was exciting. So we're trying to veer him towards one that's a safe bet. Do we think he's going to build a company? Yes. Do we think that company is going to be worth 10 million US? Yes. Maybe 20. But the other company is 100, 500 min, if he can do it. And it's global as well. We can figure out a way how we get that thing global very quickly. So it's that domain expertise that people have is what you're trying to extract from them and see how they can apply it to the problems. I think the unfortunate thing is that sometimes people don't have that filter to be able to bounce something off someone that can figure out if this could be a huge business. And that's why we kind of try to fit entrepreneurs with the sectors that they're going after, so they can actually do the best in finding out those unique opportunities in them.
We created the Afropolitan podcast because we wanted to make sure we tell the stories of those who came before us and those who are coming in front of us.
Our stories deserve to be documented and remembered.
And over here at Afropolitan, our drink of choice is Inveroche, which is a gin from South Africa, because we believe African brands are global. So Eche, what are you toasting to?
To our builders, our innovators, to show that Black brilliance exists worldwide.
I am toasting to African creativity. I feel like the world is just blossoming with beautiful African storytellers.
Here's to legacy.
And stories worth sharing.
Actually, to even double tap more into that, how important would you say self-awareness is for a founder, especially when you're evaluating a founder and maybe the startup they're pitching you?
Very. I'd say self-awareness is very high up there, but introspection is a very big commodity that an entrepreneur should have. Because I think you're going to get comments, feedback, input from all sides. The natural state sometimes is to be defensive, but the more learned state is to be able to take the probe and take the input and then just introspect and say, you know, I've thought about it and there's some value in this, there's no value in that. I'll take this, I'll leave that. And I think that's what gets to self-awareness, is that if you're introspective, you can actually get to that self-awareness.
And actually, speaking of that, one of the questions I have around just even founders bringing ideas to you is, what do you tell a founder who's passionate about their idea but is not the right fit to lead it? And honestly, I wish more people had this reflection, because I was in a company that probably should have happened. So I'm curious, what would you say to them?
You know, the older I get, the more subtle and political I can be. My natural state is just to tell them. And that is just what I would like to do. But you realize that at the same time, there are people that are sharing dreams with you. And it's a fine line between sort of killing somebody's dream and being very, very direct. In my 20s, when I was a lot younger, I was just, your idea sucks and you suck. But if you got a better person, maybe the idea could work, but it's not you. And then the person would essentially retrench back into their shell. But now we try to just evaluate and see if we can be more additive. So if we think that you are not the right person, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, do we think the idea is viable enough to invest the time in trying to, one, get you coached, or two, surround you with people that can help you, or three, encourage you to share the seat of power and get a COO, or ultimately phase out and you become whatever it is that you do very well and let them help you run the company. But I think, first of all, the decision we would have to make is, do we think the opportunity is vast enough? We have seen... There was a company we were going to invest in about 5 years ago, right? And we met with the entrepreneur. We're like, wow, it's not a sector we ever thought of. He seems to be killing it. Sounds good. So we met. We asked to meet the rest of the team. And there was just something niggling at us. We were like, we don't like the next phase of the strategy. It just seems like it's personal. So I asked them a question about it just to explore. And I said, yeah, it's personal. It has nothing to do with where the natural state of the company should go. And we said, let's meet the entire team. So the entire team met. We met them at a restaurant. And we asked them, what do you think of the next phase? And like, it sucks. We don't like it. And he erupted. He's like, I'm the CEO. I have the lead. You follow what I say. And we're like, okay, good idea, but we're not doing this. So we realize that there are great ideas out there, but the construct might not be the right one for us. If we can find someone that can help him get through that as a co-investor, then we would bring that co-investor along. They can work with him and we can get to where we're going to get to. But if we can't, then it doesn't make any sense.
And I'm also curious, you know, because you talked about investors in the past being burnt. What are lies that you feel founders are often telling, or kind of like patterns you've seen?
Stories.
This yeah, is like, yeah, stories. I want a story.
Stories. I don't think a lot of the entrepreneurs we've invested in are negative in terms of the intent is not to harm. So the intent might be this lack of self-awareness, as in what they do. So we've had founders that we thought were building companies that if we put our muscle behind it and our efforts and team could get to a $1 billion company. But the founder was more interested in going on excursions and conferences and speaking. It's very hard to build a company when you're not interested in building the company. And I think that's where you get vanity entrepreneurs. So I think that's a self-awareness thing. There's some entrepreneurs that don't realize they're doing it because they want to be in the press. They want to go to shows. They want to be identified. Someone described it yesterday as the t-shirt wearing crowd. You're walking everywhere with your company's name on the t-shirt so they'd identify you with Hot Company X. So I think awareness seems to be the bigger thing, that the self-awareness that people don't realize why they're trying to build a company or what it takes. As I tell entrepreneurs, building a company is hard. And if you're not in it for the long term, you can get very old, very jaded, and eject very quickly. So I don't think a lot of people have like an intention of defrauding someone. But it might be that you've raised money, you're doing the things you're supposed to do, you go to Egypt on a conference and people are having champagne and, you know, you're saying, I can't afford this, but you now move into paying yourself more. And so you can enjoy the same kind of lifestyle that maybe your counterparts in other countries might be enjoying at conferences. So it might start out that small and then it just escalates from there.
And even like, what is a pitch that you've gotten from African founder that wasn't good? Like you're like, these are the signs of a founder that's just really not ready for investment.
A sector mismatch. It's like you ask them to tell you what is the pain point in the sector and they can't tell you anything about it. That's usually dead on arrival. We can't do anything there because they can't educate us about the opportunity. And when we ask questions to them, they cannot elaborate what it is they're trying to solve. So we always find that where we get the disconnect is when we ask, what is the problem you're solving? And they can't encapsulate it well. Now, there are some problems that are emerging. So let's say someone turns around and you say, what is the problem you're solving on a blockchain side with crypto? And they're like, I can't articulate it, but let me tell you what I think it could be and how it could be used. And that's insightful. But when you have no insight and nothing to share, it's very hard to do a deal.
Mm. I think one of the things I've observed with being back here more is sometimes you meet an entrepreneur who's maybe a local entrepreneur who might not have necessarily been exposed to like a global market. Very passionate, very driven. If you evaluate them based on the market, they're ready to go. But sometimes they want foreign investment. And you're like, this spot here, I don't think this is going to work with the foreigners who are evaluating you because you're not context switching. As somebody who's had a perspective of both sides of, you know, both the West and then also on the continent, how do you package a founder for follow-on funding when you know that their idea and their product, everything else is matching, but how do you like package the founder, especially when you know like, okay, me, I might understand your context, but if we take you to these other rooms, it might not vibe. So how do we do that?
Well, you want to be careful with that because we always want entrepreneurs to be their authentic selves.
Yeah.
So the first thing is, are you solving a problem? Are you executing on it? Are you essentially delivering the growth that you're supposed to? If you do that, we can find a way to get around the investors, to get them acclimated to you. And we've had companies where founders are a little bit introverted, a little bit prickly, but they're chasing an amazing opportunity. So we found a way to smoothen the road for them to talk to investors. So I think those are things that if you have, and this is why I tell entrepreneurs, you have to look at your investors not as a club. So you have a club of 50 people that invested in you, but nobody's vouching for you. That's a tough place to be. You want to be in a place where somebody has led a deal and they're actually saying, I'm making a bet on you, your company, where you're going, fully in. And if you can do that, then it lets you have this relationship where you can now have these frank thing discussions. And you say, look, we're going to be meeting an investor that's very polished. You, my guy, are not. So what we're going to do is we're not going to set it in a restaurant where the guy is using a knife and fork and you're like going all elbow in. We're going to do something casual. We'll do it in the office because we want the person to see your brilliance and how you engage. So you can adjust the settings that allow the person to be most comfortable to show the brilliance that they have. But I think it's just one, being all in on the on the company and the entrepreneur, and then being able to help them. And I think these are conversations that you can have. We have portfolio companies where 2023, during the downturn, I was getting calls at 1 a.m. as in entrepreneurs close to tears and the frustration and the challenges. And you're just looking for a way to get through it. And you can have those frank conversations to help them build the companies you know that they can build.
In the ZERP era, for our viewers, that's a zero interest payment era, the African tech ecosystem raised about $6.5 billion in 2022. But that's down significantly in the years past, right? How did Beta Ventures navigate that era, especially in chasing deal flow, where I'm pretty sure there might have been like eye-popping valuations where you're like, we don't enter at that price point. And can you educate our viewers as to the importance, especially in terms of the stage a VC is in when they're evaluating your decision to invest in a company, what that looks like? But first, can we talk about that era and what that looked like from you guys' perspective?
The bubble era. We had someone that went through YC, Nigerian fintech, went through YC. We asked them, what's your valuation? What's the post on this safe? And without missing a beat, he said 50 million. Well, I got it. And we turned around and we left. It's not for us. So I think that era sort of had people push outlandish valuations. And they could, because the appetite was there for people to participate. They needed or wanted to have an Africa play. So they would put money at those valuations. Now, not to say that the valuations were wrong, but the valuation base that they were coming from did not match the African market. So you could be in Silicon Valley, you could get a $50 million valuation because the movement of valuation could be very rapid. But in Nigeria, you're still going to have to come back to the local market. You have to deal with the dollar, naira, or a dollar different exchange rate. You have a depreciating currency. So all the effort you have gets diminished on externals. So you have to factor all these things in. So the way we navigated is that we had dry powder, so we're able to still invest. And our concentration was on existing portfolio companies. How do we help them survive? So if you look at a lot of VCs, they'll talk to you about how, you know, 30% of their portfolio is dead or 40%. Our portfolio is very low in terms of debt. We might have one or two companies. And even then, we're trying to salvage and we're trying to see if we can do a merger for the technology, and very actively doing so. Now, in terms of valuation and plays in the space, I think what a lot of entrepreneurs don't realize is that the way they look for money from VCs is the way we look for money from LPs and their promises made to the LPs. So if we invest in a company, our minimum expectation is that our check to you should be able to return the fund. So if we have, let's say, a $1 million fund and we write a $100,000 check, in our mind, you should be a minimum 10x minimum. If we go into a deal and we're writing sort of a $20,000 check, in our minds, you should be at least a 50x. If we're writing a check at 250, 4x. But the idea is that we have to get a certain target return on an investment. So investing high is a bad strategy for us. We can't go into a company at 50 million and put the money in. And in our calculation, we think the company might exit at 250. It doesn't work. It hasn't sort of given us the exit that we want for the money in. So what we do guide entrepreneurs on is, if you're doing a pre-seed, try to get that pre-seed in the neighborhood of a million or less. If you're doing a seed, you should probably be in that 2 million.
That's raising, not valuation.
No, valuation.
Okay.
Once you have figured out your product, because that's the key thing, is getting to product market fit. Once you get to product market fit, then I think you start talking to VCs. Some people are talking to VCs very early. And sometimes it's because they have experience in the space, so they already know VCs. It's their second go around or third go around, and that's fine. But if you haven't shown that you can bring a product to market, it's a lot more difficult to have those conversations with a VC.
You know, the other part around that time, because we also raised during that period, was a lot of founders don't know how they actually screw themselves over with even the high valuation, right? So if you're raising at a $50 million valuation out the gate, you have to match that for your next round. And a lot of founders then go on to have a down round, right? So how do you advise founders around that?
So the suggestion that we have is pre-seed, raise locally, and raise it from people around you. So basically, it's almost like they're giving you money because they're saying, I'm taking a chance on you, and so on. And raise it in local denomination. So whether you're here in Ghana, Kenya, that's a suggestion we have. I think once you get to seed, raise locally as well, but it might be slightly more institutional or family office, local. I think at that stage, once you've brought your product to market, you can figure out, is this going to be a big opportunity or is it going to be a small one or a mid-size? Because then you can ensure that your returns are commensurate with the investment that went in. So if you're a company that raised, let's say, 10 million naira and you did it at 100 million naira post, you gave up 10%, you got to the market, you realize that your company is not going to be Pan-African, which it needs to be for a dollar denomination, let's say. And the company now is only going to grow to doing revs of, 400-500 million naira a year. And that is where you are comfortable leaving that business. You want it to be a small operation, and that's it. Then basically that's actually a hit, because the dividend payout from that could be 100% on investment every year. Mm-hmm. And everyone is happy. The problem is, once you bring venture capital, hard currency investment into it, the aspiration has to be significantly higher. And if you're not ready to build that, then it's tough. There are actually two young women that were building a company, and somebody referred me to them and said, talk to them because they're looking for venture capital. I had a conversation, and it's this thing that I go back to, talking to entrepreneurs just to find out what they're trying to build, where their core is. So they passed everything in terms of core, understanding, dedication, and so on. So we came back to the question we like to ask entrepreneurs, which is, what is the number that you would like to see for an exit? And they're like, we haven't really thought about that. I was like, no, think about it. It's a core thing. And they came back with that they were looking to get $5 million and that would be good. And I was like, okay, well, if you're doing $5 million, you see how there's a mismatch between your objectives and ours. So I can help you as like a pseudo mentor, but I can't invest in you because our aspirations are not the same. It is okay to have a company that's doing 1 billion naira per year and throwing off 200, 250 million. Everyone is happy. But once you have this fallacy that you're trying to grow a venture-backed company and you raise that money and you get that $50 million valuation and they're asking you to go, 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 and you can't go, there's a problem.
Well, you don't think sometimes it's a exposure thing? The reason why I'm asking is, I remember at the time, there were other people who would be raising and their whole thing would be, hey, I'm raising $100,000 or $200,000 or even $300,000. Even when I went to Rwanda, I mean, I would have founders come up to me and say, I'm raising $50,000. And the way they're thinking about it is, if you give me this $50,000, I will give you the world, right? Yeah. I remember having to explain to them, like, you know, this is actually a red flag to VCs who have maybe a minimum size check of maybe $500,000 to a million. Because they're saying, how can I give you 100K and you're going to return my whole fund? How is that possible? Now, sometimes from the founder's perspective, they don't necessarily understand that because they're thinking, well, just give me small check, I'll return you Jesus's talents, right? And you're saying to them, like, no, this is not a scarcity thing. This is about deploying capital at scale if I need to. Do you not think sometimes it's an exposure thing? And if you do recognize that it's an exposure thing, does it make you still say, maybe we shouldn't proceed with investing here? Or now that your eye has been opened, maybe by me as a potential investor, are you dreaming bigger or are you still staying with your $5 million?
So I wouldn't classify it exposure per se, but
ambition, maybe?
I would put it as critical reasoning. And I think the reason I say this is because I just went through this with my daughter that's doing her own startup. And I think the critical reasoning is just putting a number on the board, putting an aspirational number. So you ask someone, you are building, let's use a food truck, or let's say food, let's not use food trucks. You say, how many meals do you think you can provide in a day? And the person's like, oh my goodness, if things go really well, 200. You're like, okay, did you pick the 200 because you worked forwards or you picked the 200 because you worked backwards? How large is the market? And they'll say, oh, Lagos has 26 million people or 20 million people. And I said, okay, so you're only looking to feed 0.08. And the person's like, okay, so if I could feed 200,000 people a day, what would you need? And then you work backwards as in, if you can sort of take a 200, bring it back to the units of what does that mean in portions? What does that mean in distribution points? How many people need to be serving? How many? Then you can actually figure out that to get to 200,000, you need 15 locations. That's really the rubric. It's the math of it. But people haven't gone through that critical thinking, working backwards from an aspiration. So I think what happens in the space is that people start from, like I'm saying, where they know where they are. And it is just, let me go a little forward from here if I can, like, 5X and so on. So when I did my first startup, we're poor young guys building a company in Silicon Valley. And we were doing very much the same thing. So we said, we built a credit report company. And we were the first company to do credit reports online, real time, and so on. So we launched it, and we're doing like one a day, three a day. So we ran the math, and we said, you know, for us to break even, we need to do 33 a day. So let's figure out how do we get to 33. Then we started going out, figuring it out, and then the numbers started rising. We hit 35 a day, and we're like, this is great. We've hit the number. The world didn't change. Nothing happened. It's just that we were break even. And then looking at what we were doing, like by the third month of the sales, my co-founder and I said, we're going to have to quit this if we don't have a material change. So we sat down one day and I said, what is the biggest thing that we can do? And the biggest thing we could do is to have a strategic relationship with Yahoo. Yahoo at the time was just Monster and so on. So he said, he's a tech guy. He's like, how do we get there? And I said, don't worry, we'll figure it out. So I sent an email to TK, the CEO of Yahoo. I figured out his email structure. We did it like five times.
Cold email.
Cold email. And we did it on December 22nd December 23rd. TK landed in New York, saw the email, responded, and said, "We'd be very interested in partnering with you. I'm on a flight to Paris, but when I get to Paris, I'll let the people know you guys should explore a deal." Very different numbers. After the deal with Yahoo, we did a deal with AOL. We did a deal with Microsoft. But it's just changing the perspective of saying, for us to be able to do a deal with Yahoo, what did we have to do? And what we had to do is we had to upgrade our systems, our process, and all those things, databases and everything else. So we were able to do that. We were able to absorb the Yahoo deal. And that's how we raised our first venture. We raised $2.5 million off that because of the volume that we were pushing. Mm-hmm. We actually did a pre-Yahoo deal, but because of the ambition we now had, we stopped doing the nickel and dime deals and we started doing the dollar deals. Yeah. And that's what got us scale. So I think it's being able to have perspective on the possible and being able to intellectually figure out, if I want to get there, what are the numbers need to be now for me to get to the destination.
And I'm also curious because I'm reflecting back as you're speaking about my early days as a founder, trying to figure out like, okay, I was in the US, I moved back to Nigeria. I don't know anyone really because I didn't grow up here either. And having to find my way through like getting to investors and getting to, you know, understand that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we had recently on our YouTube channel was, this is great information, but I don't know anyone. I'm a founder. I need to raise capital. So what advice would you give to that founder who knows they want to raise capital, but they don't have any connections?
This is a tough one. Raising capital is art and relationships. It's not science. So I think in this environment, you'll find that there are certain people that invest. And the challenge for entrepreneurs is how to connect to those folks. As they say, you can't hunt lions in your living room. You got to be in the wild. So wherever those people are is where you would like to start being and start engaging with. I think the easiest... So there's a deal that we're looking at right now. We heard about the company, and I think the entrepreneur reached out to me. And I dismissed it because I just felt that he didn't have enough context. He had been at this for a while. And I said, I needed to hear about this company from somewhere else. Someone who was already an investor in him that wrote a small check just came up and said, I really am interested and excited about this guy. And I said, tell me about him. And he told me about him. And that facilitated the introduction. And we're now talking about what he's building, and we're doing sort of a preliminary D on him sector company. So I think it's important for people to realize that connectors matter. And connectors, they don't just matter here. If you're in Silicon Valley and you were from the US and you were from New York and you're investment banking and you were dropped in San Francisco, you don't know anyone, which means you start to reach back to your school, your alumni network, people you know, let's figure out how do I connect. I think LinkedIn is actually a very great tool for that because you can figure out how many steps away am I from this person and who is the connector? And if you can find a connector, it makes that conversation so much easier, so much easier.
And also, I want to now talk about a hot topic, which is AI, right? And honestly, most of the information I'm seeing as startups, technology, people, what they're building, whatever, is all Western focus. I'm really not seeing enough like AI activity here in Africa. And I know it's happening. I know people are building things. So I'm curious, what are you seeing and what are things that maybe we don't have business building? Because the last investor we spoke to was like, look, all the large language models have been built. So anyone that's trying to tell me in Nigeria I'm building one, it's like, I think he's wasting our time. So I'm curious, like, what are you seeing and what's interesting to you?
So I think AI is new. So it's an emerging space. And the speed with which it's emerging is very interesting. I think in terms of what we're seeing is we're trying to see what the applications are. So if you look at the West, a lot of Western companies are looking primarily at the base tech. So the LLMs that they're building and so on. We still think that there's an opportunity in the LLMs, but I think it's more like a DeepSeek overlay. So you're utilizing an already existing model to do some more interesting things. Because if you think about it naturally, we have a lot of languages on the African continent. And if you can feed an LLM with a language veneer, it allows customer service, response, all those things to be so easy. Now, the US doesn't have that issue. They speak English. Everyone speaks English. So when you're talking about 300 different languages that need to be translated to a command, they don't have that problem. We do. And you can use AI to do some of those things. So what we are seeing are really interesting applications that people are developing, deploying, and this goes to awareness. Sometimes they start out with the mindset that it's a problem I'm solving here. But very quickly, we tell them it's global. If you can engineer it that way. So there's an, I don't want to plug her company, but...
No, go ahead. We need to know what people are building.
So there's a young entrepreneur, very excited about what she's doing. She asked me to be an advisor first, and I said, okay, let's see what you're doing. It's called Talk To, and they just won Pitch to Win. So she's building something that's really interesting, and it's really using AI platforms for speech therapy. And these are people that have, you know, speech therapy. You can't pay for it because you can't afford the specialist. So you move it to an AI platform that enables you to get through it. But once you've built it, it's global on day one. So I think it's those kinds of really interesting applications. When you talk to the team, speech therapists is half the team. So they know what it's part of what they do, but they've just figured out a way to make it cheaper, faster, more distributed. So I think it's those kinds of applications that we're looking at. And we think that's where we would excel. If someone shows up and they talk about building a new Prism chip and everything, you're like, okay, there's like NVIDIA, there's AMD, there's a whole host of people doing chips in this sector. So chip fab investment, I'm not saying it won't happen, but the probability is very low that it will happen unless the person has come to us from the chip sector and they come in and they say, you know, for us, there's an educational device that we can deliver to the market because we know that edtech needs to be distributed because we can't build enough schools. In Nigeria, for instance, 20 million school-age kids not in school. So how do you educate them? Well, you're going to have to do it device, distributed, probably AI. Price points for a lot of the devices might be too high. So chipset, the drops that price point significantly with a footprint allows you to deliver that to the market. So that would be the tie-in that makes sense. But that is from insight and experience and sector that we would be able to see. So what we try to do is we, as investors, if you have the patience to listen to entrepreneurs, you're able to actually discover if they have something. And sometimes when you're not listening, you have to have people around you that can direct them to you so you can actually listen to the stories that they're telling and the things that they're building.
I know I was watching a Sam Altman video from when he was at YC, Y Combinator. And he was talking about the steps in evaluating a startup or how to launch a successful startup. And he says idea, product, talent, execution, and luck. That's what he says. And I remember at the time, this is post-raise, you're like, I wish I'd watched this before.
Yeah.
But one of the things I advise founders now that I feel like, especially in our market, we typically tend to under index on is talent, right? And just the people you're going to go on this journey with, whether it's as co-founders or as even, you know, first set of employees as you hire, right?
Yeah.
What are some like frameworks you advise founders in thinking around talent, or even as when a founder comes to you and you're like, maybe you need a co-founder. What are some frameworks you advise founders to navigate that with?
So this is actually one of the things that I covered in the book that I wrote, The Founder Fit, is people need to know their gaps. And you can actually go through a numerical process to figure out where the gaps are. So if you look at a startup, you look at the things you believe it needs, and you evaluate yourself against those things. So maybe you are an organization that requires sales, and your gap is you're an engineer, you haven't sold, you don't like to sell. So on a scale of 1 to 10, you're a 1, but the sector requires a 10. That's a 9 spread that you need to cover. So I think the first is understanding where the gaps are, and then figuring out how you're going to close those gaps. Now, it might be you're hiring to close the gap. Maybe you have an advisor to close the gap. Maybe it's a co-founder because it's core. So the core gaps that you need to close need to be like co-founder or core team and so on. So I think it's to identify those gaps. Now, here's the overlay. The overlay is belief. You could get the most skilled, talented person that doesn't believe in what the mission is and the direction. And what will end up happening is, as I've said before, startups are tough. Once it just gets slightly tough, it's an eject. The person hits the eject button and they're out. So I think it's seek the talent, try to figure out the gaps to close those, but try to find people that have belief. These are missionaries as well. So there's this talk that I did regarding mercenaries versus missionaries, that you need mercenary thinking people when you get to a certain stage. But the early stages, it's belief. If you're looking to change the world, change things, people really have to wake up in the morning and they have to wear that belief, and they come in knowing it is a massive problem for us to solve with the little capital we have, but we can do it. And that's how they start the day, and that's how they should hopefully end the day.
How did your exit expectations change transitioning from the U.S. back to Nigeria? And what I mean by that is, obviously, in the U.S., a startup launches, they can exit by being acquired, potential IPO, or merge, right? When you come to a place like Nigeria, where we have underdeveloped capital markets, not on the same level as the U.S., right? How did your expectations transition to say, hey, we can go for a popping IPO? I think Figma just launched at like $93 a share or something, and that's like billions of dollars worth of shares on the market. How do you make that transition to say, hey, at best, I don't know if IPO is NGX, but NGX is like an $80 billion valuation market today, but I'm sure at the time it was much lower. How did you transition with that?
So you have to work at it. Because we are an emerging market, and there are certain exits that are not open to you. So there's a balancing act of what's available, and then there's the balancing act of entrepreneur expectation. And I will say that the press does not do founders any service by always posting stories of these, two Sigma outtails. Of so-and-so started a company, and within 3 years they had done this, and then it's a $1 billion company, and now they're worth X. So that sets the expectation of a lot of founders. Now, we've gone through the first cycle of entrepreneurs, so we're now on second and third. So those expectations have become more realistic, so that's a good thing. Now, on the capital market side, you realize the options you have are acquisition, merger, IPOs, secondaries, sell downs, management buyouts, and so on. So the options are there. Now, it might not be apparent to the entrepreneurs, but those are the options. The IPO market has been very difficult. And for African IPOs on tech, with the exception of Jumia, I don't think anyone is close. And it's because the capital markets in the US are not looking for billion-dollar companies. They're looking for $50 billion companies because the people that are taking stock at the IPO are the BlackRocks of the world, the Vanguards.
Fidelities.
They're controlling, you know.
Trillions
yeah. in assets. So to come in with an IPO that you're selling $100 million on, it doesn't move the needle for anyone. They need to be able to move the needle. So I think the aspirations that our founders have of doing an IPO in the US, and that's the goal, scale it back, dial it all the way back. Now we get to the NGX. The question is, you want deep pools of capital with the liquidity. An NGX is a challenge. So if you look at the trading on the NGX, it's limited to a basket of stocks where you have deep pools of liquidity. You can go in and out. So we were looking at doing something with the NGX for a new tech board. And we were supposed to be one of the first companies that listed on that new tech board. But that got shifted. So the expectations around exits are we do need a board that allows IPOs to occur on the African continent. That's a must. It's going to take time to get there. But in the interim, it's going to be buyouts, mergers, secondaries. If you can get a company that is doing enough business, the management can actually buy you out. We actually did that with one of our portfolio companies, one of our exits. But you have to be creative about the exits that you construct in this market. Whereas in the US, you didn't have to be as creative. Your banker would just lay it out, but put the numbers and you pick the best option and then off you go.
But what happens to the foreign investors, especially, you know, a lot of them in, based in the US who are investing in Africa, and they might have an expectation of either dollar returns or IPO level returns, right? I don't think many investors in the US who are investing in African startups are saying, hey, well, if you go on the NGX and get us back Naira, we'll take that, especially in this devaluation market. So how have those, what have you seen in terms of their expectations being managed? Because I know some founders now report revenue in Naira versus dollar when it was much more stable. So what has that looked like from your perspective?
So I think the exit side, they're just going to have to get creative. So the creativity is usually around mergers. So the M&A market, I mean, if there are some bankers that are out there that want to figure out what they should be doing, it's how do I get some of these African companies that are doing well into the right channels for M&A? So some entrepreneurs are being proactive about it right now. So they're buying each other or merging with each other and so on. So they are developing some of those exits. But capital markets are not that mature. So we're going to have to figure out the creative things to do to get the exits that we need. We still need a capital market that allows IPOs to emerge on the African continent. So these companies have a place to go and it should be liquid. But in lieu of that, we're going to have to do a lot of M&A.
And just out of curiosity, is there any startups that you regret passing on?
Venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, you have these very interesting things where people always do the retro and say, I regret passing on, blah, blah, blah. But at the time, you knew why you passed. And maybe this didn't happen or this didn't happen or that didn't happen or you were unsure about this. So I would say it's less the regret of passing and more the rubric that you used
to evaluate
them. So maybe it's to go back to the rubric and say, okay, maybe I was too extreme on that aspect. Because if I weren't, he would have passed through or she would have passed through and I would have made that investment. So I think it's less, I mean, there are companies that, Lemfi, for instance, I mean, the guy pitched us. But for one reason or other, we actually just had this conversation as a fund and said, why did we pass on Lensfire? And then we were reminded why. And we're like, okay, so we know why. So that was it. So Lensfire has done a fantastic job and we passed on them.
But that goes back to the introspection we were talking about, right? So when you pass, the passes also even teach you something,
yes.
Especially when, you know, you see how it pans out.
Yeah.
So what, aside from Lemfi, what other companies have come through where you now had to go back to your to your introspection rubric, because there's the fund rubric, but I also think that there's an introspection framework too, where you're like, maybe this was a thing I had here and I didn't realize it, or this is what we have as an entity that we didn't realize. What does that look like when you're evaluating that and saying, maybe this is something we might need somebody else who has another sort of perspective that can catch this? Like, it's almost like policing yourself, basically. Yeah.
So I'll tell you an interesting story that has nothing to do with the Nigerian market, but taught me perspective about this. I was in Silicon Valley, and there's a VC in Silicon Valley that I know, and he's grown to be sort of a friend, called Bill Gurley. So Bill is, or was, general partner, Benchmark, and so on. So I had just sold a company, and I was figuring out what to do next. So Bill and I had lunch, and that's it. So Bill calls me like a couple of weeks afterwards, and he's like, hey, dude, I was wondering if you could go see this company. They're looking for a new exec. One of their execs jumped off and is becoming a partner over at our fund. It leaves an opening. Thought you might be a good fit. Go have a chat. And I was like, what company is it? And he tells me, and I was like, I don't know. Let me think about it. It's not for me. I wouldn't use it. It was Facebook, and it was Zuck.
Wait, what?
That was the deal.
It's not for me.
I didn't use Facebook.
Wait. How old were you? Weren't using Facebook?
No, remember. So my brother used Facebook. He was in university.
So you were slightly ahead.
Yeah, I'm ahead of him. So I might look young, but I'm not. So Facebook ahead. Bill made that introduction and said he was going to make the introduction. I said, I got to really think about it.
Pre-IPO, I'm assuming.
Oh, this is Facebook way before IPO. Okay. I think it ultimately ended up that they constructed it. They took the position, they merged it in, and Sheryl Sandberg ultimately ended up doing
it. Wait, you could have been Sheryl Sandberg?
I couldn't have been Sheryl. Sheryl did that job amazingly
Obviously, Sheryl Sandberg,
But the point is, this gap was created.
Yeah.
Bill gave the call. The assessment I had of the company was for my brother using Facebook. And I didn't think much of it, because I hadn't seen the numbers. So what that teaches you in life is that it doesn't matter what people are building. Find out about it. Ask the questions. Look at the numbers. Look at the trends, and so on. So I think it's that lesson of introspection. So every time you miss something, you must be introspective. You must go back and say, what did I miss on this? What can I learn from this? Because nobody is infallible. You're always going to make mistakes. But it's to learn from it. I see Etcha saying Facebook.
I'm trying to sit here. Because you know what's crazy about Facebook? So one of my investors from my first company was like employee, like maybe 90 or something. And he's a multimillionaire. And so I'm just like, if you were in there, I mean, luckily we have Nigerians inside, but I don't know. I just wonder.
No, it's very, and I think that's the great thing about technology, and that's the thing that we like about tech. For instance, I was at business school, and it's a very interesting story. So I was at business school, and one of my classmates was like employee number 46 at this startup in China. So he invited the CEO to come speak, and I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. So he told me about it, and I said, I'm just going to go see him. So you have to think, business school, Wharton, top school, and he's attracting this Chinese entrepreneur that's coming in to talk about what he's building. But this is back to 2002. So the guy comes in. I'm in the crowd. Let me not even say crowd. Let's call it group. And they're like 26, 30 of us that are listening to him. It was Jack Ma.
Of Alibaba.
Nobody came to see Jack Ma. Heard him speak. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. E-commerce at scale. Sounds cool and everything. But you realize that it's only apparent in retrospect.
Hindsight.
Hindsight is the thing. So the question is, why would Jack Ma come to a business school and JP Morgan CEO is getting a full room. Jack Ma is not getting a full room. It's just that it's not apparent then. So you have to start asking yourselves, can I figure out the signals, the early signals?
Yeah.
To figure out what's going to emerge. Because we as VCs, we don't play when it's apparent. It's too late. You have to play on significantly early signals. Yeah. So the way we do it is we create a thesis about sectors that we're interested in, and we delve into those sectors, and what we're watching for are signals in those sectors. So if you look at, say, the Nigerian market, like for us, we looked at the Nigerian market and we're like, you're not going to get Ubers, Bolts, and all that in the market moving until the signal was the cost of data. And we put a marker, as in once data gets to, I think the marker was a gigabyte for 500 naira. That's the marker it becomes. So you stop watching the other things and you start watching the signal point to give you the signal that it's the right time to start doing e-commerce. Because it can be ubiquitous across the platform because now it's affordable. Else it's sheltered to a very small segment of the market.
Do you have any signals on the creator economy? Like, is that part of your thesis at all?
Culture and media, maybe.
Yeah.
It's not a sector that we have done a lot on. So our domain knowledge on that space is not deep. There is a young entrepreneur that's building something on the creator side that we're watching. His name is James. He knows who he is if he's watching this. So we've been watching him. We're very excited about what he's creating because he really loves what he's creating. He has deep insight into what he's creating. It's showing early signals as to what people are adopting, but it's unconventional. It's new.
Wait, what is it? Like, can you explain?
So what he's done is he's said that, look, the thesis is people don't read as much. So if you sort of take content and you bring it down to bite size and you make it daily, people will read more. So his platform is a user-generated content platform that allows people to create content that they share. And the numbers are pretty interesting. So people are writing stories, writing mini books, articles, and they're sort of parsing it down to small content shots that people are consuming. So we think that it could be a very interesting thing, but it's new and you don't know what the adoption would be, but the early signs are there that he has found something that could be quite interesting.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a very crazy question, but I'm just curious because we talked about Silicon Valley, Nigeria, and if someone was to offer you $200 million to leave Africa tech market and go back to Silicon Valley, would you do it?
When does the wire clear?
I wasn't expecting that answer.
What are we talking about? I could invest from New York.
So wait, what keeps you here?
So one of the things we did is that I exited the last company, and one of the things was the kids were getting to a certain age, and my daughter was in a private school, so it means that she is one of very few black kids, and she came back and she had a hair episode. She was like into hair, about how hair is not good. I was like, wow, my kids have reached that age where culture of who they are is starting to dawn on them. So my wife and I discussed it and we said it made sense for the kids to grow up here and spend the years here, those formative years. Yeah. And I know how those formative years were for me. And I grew up around the world, but my parents are like, okay, you know, boarding school in England is cool, but you're doing boarding school in Nigeria.
Yeah.
So imagine transition boarding school in England to like, that was back in the day of junior boys and wearing shorts. So I did, we were the first set of JS. So it was JS3.
You went to King's College, right?
I went to Federal Government College.
Oh, Federal
Government. Enugu. Enugu. Oh. Yeah, FGCE.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm not Floriat. I'm pro Unitate. So I did that, and yeah. It was so formative for me. with friends and the networks and the people. And I'd say boarding school in Nigeria teaches you about people.
Yeah.
You understand people really well. At their core, you really understand them. So we felt that that would be a great experience for the kids. So the kids came, a little bit of an adjustment, but I think it's been a phenomenal, phenomenal stay for the kids here. Capital, on the other hand, once the kids are done and they've learned their lesson, 200 million is 200 million.
In any market.
In any market. That's fine.
Okay, your book talks about lifestyle businesses versus scalable startups. When you look at the African ecosystem, do you see too many people building lifestyle businesses when they should be thinking bigger or vice versa?
I think people should be where they are. So if you are a person that wants a lifestyle business, because you have to remember that companies are organic beings and companies desire to expand and grow, which means the organisms, the people, the management has to expand and grow, which means you have to stretch your capabilities, learn more things. If you're not that person, you're building a lifestyle business. You want to be where you are. And that's okay. It's just realize that up front. But if a company requires growth of going from the 20 people you can manage comfortably, and it needs to grow to 2,000 people that you're uncomfortable managing, then one of two things have to change. Either you, the management side, has to change, or you have to upscale. And I think that's where people have a challenge. Now, the other that is a little bit more difficult is trying to make a lifestyle business scale when it shouldn't. Because you're trying to grow something that should not naturally grow. Or you have to figure out a new way or a new prism to look through to be able to figure out how it grows in a way that makes it very big. And I think that's the challenge sometimes is that the MD or CEO of a company says, I heard about AI, I heard about this. Let's figure out how we jump on the AI train and let's figure out how we, I heard companies are doing 10X, we should 10X this. But, you know, the foundation of the company and the sector might not lend itself to that.
You also wrote about avoiding decision paralysis, but African markets can be incredibly complex. 42 currencies, 3,000 plus languages. How do you help founders move from analysis to action when the market data might be incomplete or unreliable?
Movement. You just have to move. So there's a saying that I like, which is when you have a decision to make and you don't make it, that in and of itself is a decision. So you just have to decide how to move forward. And the only way to eat an elephant is small bites. So you can't think about eating the elephant. You just have to start eating. So with entrepreneurs that are doing things, you can't think about 42 currencies. You can't think about 54 countries. Even in Nigeria, you can't think about 774 LGAs. You just have to start where you are. And once you start where you are, it gives you proof of whether this makes sense or doesn't make sense. And then what is required for the extension of that. And then once you figure that out and you know you can deal in those different environments, then you can figure out how you can sort out new environments. Now, the great thing I think about the Nigerian market is this is a tough segment. It is tough. And if you can find someone that can go through the fire of the Nigerian market and succeed, it typically means that they can enter other markets that have less complexity. As we say, you've been forged in the Nigerian fire. Which means new markets, it's like a breeze. You're walking through, whereas we might have 10 complications that you have to get through. Other markets have two or three. You're like, child's play all day.
You know, I want to transition to even go deeper into the book. In Founders Fit, you've written about finding the business idea that's right for you.
Yeah.
but you've also built and exited three companies before finding your fit with Beta Ventures. What were the signs that your earlier ventures weren't your true founder fit, or is founder fit also tied to seasons in your life?
So it's tied to seasons in your life in terms of what you're trying to do, because sometimes, let's say someone, so my first company, it was a fintech, it was an early fintech. Was my background financial services? No. My background was engineering. It was advanced space, nuclear weapons, ICBMs, fighter jets, storage containers for missile equipment. Very tech, not tech. Financial services. It's hard tech, yeah. I really wanted to do something on the startup side. So I decided, just going through the story, my co-founder and I decided that we were going to start a company. We didn't know what we were going to start. So every Saturday we'd meet in my apartment and we're brainstorming ideas and so on. So since we're tech, we decided we're going to build language software. What stopped us is sort of the foresight that after we built the language software, we had zero ability to distribute, partner, price, none of that. So we pulled it back and we ultimately decided to do credit reports. Now, credit reports in the US is like the lifeblood of buying. But back then, it wasn't digital. You had to mail in for it. And there was the advent of the internet, so we decided we were going to do that. Now, I didn't know anything about the credit industry. So what I would do at nights is I'd go to the law library, and I read the credit laws. Like over the course of 2 weeks, every night, 3 hours, reading credit casework, law, just to understand it. So if you don't know a sector, you realize you have a gap. And the choice is, are you going to close the gap? Or do you find someone to close the gap? Or you live with a gap and you know you're going to fail at some point. But it ended up being that it was the case law of credit that allowed us to argue as to why we would be able to do this. Because if you look at the credit map of the US, it's all carved out into different people have different markets and they have exclusives and everything. And the argument we made to the credit bureaus is, we're on the internet. It's a new market. There is no exclusive. Case law points to it. And they're like, oh, you know what? We agree with you. And they gave us access. So without that understanding, without knowing something about the sector, it makes it very hard. I'll say the second startup, I didn't really know. A couple of my former employees said that they were doing a startup on the gaming side and they wanted investment. I ended up investing. I became the interim CEO and ultimately the CEO. It's a little weird because I don't play games. I used to. I used to game when I was younger, but I stopped gaming to spend more time on life. And what you will find is that was a really uncomfortable role for me because and this is where I think VCs that keep founders in place at companies and upscale them do better in emerging technology markets because intrinsically you know something about where a market is going. You know where it's headed. You know its pulse. I didn't have a good sense of the pulse of the gaming market. I remember when we had this title as God of War, the first one. God of War is flying off the shelf, and I didn't understand why. And the co-founders were telling me about, oh, the gameplay is amazing and it does. And I was like, lost on me. So when you're looking at new titles that are coming out on the gaming side, you have to think about it as if you're a gamer to figure out which ones are going to work out well or which studios produce the best types of things. So that's where the fit comes in, is that if you're not fit, you can't have an intrinsic feel of where a market is going, how it's going to move, when there's a fork, which way the market is going to go in the fork. And I think that's why that fit is a key thing. Now, if it is you've reached a point in your life where you're not fit, you're just going to have to put the work in to get fit. And if you can't figure out a way to get fit, then you realize there's a gap.
What about the third company?
Third company was back to fintech. Smooth sailing. So third company was building off an initial concept of the first company. And I was so comfortable in that market, I actually filed a patent around the idea and we got issued patents and everything. So you know it. And we ultimately sold that patent to Nathan Myhrvold, former CTO of Microsoft and his patent company. We sold him that patent.
So you've been able to play as both the founder and now the investor. What sort of perspectives do you think you've brought from both sides, especially when dealing with founder burnout? I think it's a thing that comes up now where maybe in our generation, we speak more about mental health, burnout, how you maybe potentially might find a balance because sometimes it's impossible. But how do you navigate the two between managing your startup, maybe trying to start a family, maybe trying to have kids? What perspective do you now bring as an investor to the founder?
The funny side is that founders are soft. But I don't think founders are soft. I think what people are trying to do is create work-life balance. There isn't a balance. It's just accept there isn't a balance. There are some things that are going to suffer when you do it. You can't go with the full intensity of building a startup and have the time to go with the full intensity on raising a family and have the time and intensity on expanding your careers and downtime and so on. So you realize that there's a time and there's a season for a lot of these things. So early on in the startup, it is going to be intense. Now, the expectation is that once you get traction and you have raised money, you are looking for ways to reduce that intensity for yourself. So you can now look at self-development for expansion because you have to. The person that starts a company on day one should not be the person that is running a company on like day 1001. You should have grown in some way and you should be getting ready for the road ahead. Yeah. And if you can't take that time out, it's always like nose to the grindstone. And you're not developing, then it's hard. So I'd say for founders that have sort of this balancing act, you balance as much as you can. But there isn't going to be a true balance at all. You won't find it. So the first thing we tell entrepreneurs that ask us is take that expectation, throw it out the window. And just realize that there's seasons. This season is going to be a tough one getting through. But once you get to that milestone, you can now start crafting the next one. But the balance, it's elusive.
And so now I want to transition to our rapid questions. So just whatever is top of mind. Okay. So first is, what's a guilty pleasure you spend money on?
Food.
Okay. What type of food?
It depends. So my son likes sushi. So I like sushi as well. But really well-made food.
Like gourmet.
Yeah.
Michelin star. Okay.
But I love a ribeye steak that is done amazingly well. And the other thing that I scout around the world for is chocolate cake.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you had Jaya?
I was going to say.
No.
Okay. It's right here and it's amazing.
Okay.
Probably moist. The best chocolate cake.
Moist.
Yeah. Yes.
Chocolate.
Yeah.
Cake.
Yes. It's the best chocolate cake in the world.
I will have to try it. Yeah. Then I'll come back to you with my frank self. I'm like, nah. It's a six.
Nah, I stand by this.
No, we say it's actually really, it's like moist and chocolatey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So food and...
Actually, we have some here.
Yeah, actually, we do have some.
Okay, so yes. We can always try.
actually, now that you say ribeye, is there a good ribeye in Lagos? There's one place I'm thinking that might, but not really. No.
So my wife, so this is something that I do, right, is I grill.
Oh.
So I have a grill.
Can like we come to your house for grilling?
No, so it's a grill. It's a serious, very serious thing. So sometimes we have friends that come from South Africa and they bring meats. And then there's a store that has meats. And then there's a friend that used to age beef as well, but he's no longer in Nigeria, so he's left. And you slap steaks on the grill and then there you go.
Yeah.
I think I have an Instagram picture of like steaks I was doing once, like years ago. Yeah. And I decided I'm not doing that anymore.
Actually, speaking of food, what's the childhood food from Nigeria that still brings you back?
So many. egusi soup and pounded yam with beef. Mm-hmm. There's this thing we have in our village called mirokiji, and it's hot pepper soup with yam. Mm. So it's like a yam. You think about potatoes inside like a broth mm-hmm. with meat. So it's essentially like a pepper soup with yam boiled in. So that was a childhood dish that I really liked and reminded me a lot of my grandfather as well.
Aww. And then what's one lesson about wealth that you think took you too long to learn?
Respecting money. So you have to respect money. Money demands respect, or else it comes as it goes. So if you are conscious that you have to put some respect on it,
put some respect on it.
then you'll find that you have a better relationship mm-hmm. with it. And I think oftentimes it's because, you know, the way you grow up is the way you view it. And look, I had a privileged upbringing, so I didn't really think too much about money. But then you have to start thinking about it. So it's having respect for money is one of the things.
Actually, you know why this is a good point? Because I feel like I see people that say like, oh, you know, they either have like a negative connotation about money or they have a negative connotation around people who have money. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, but that's what you want. So you can't look down on people who have found their way to wealth, but you also want wealth too. Like it never makes sense.
It doesn't quite reconcile
itself. Yeah, it doesn't.
No, I think one of the things that you think about when it comes to money is I don't think we do enough in the world to teach people about money. I don't know if it's intentional or it's just not ranking, but my kids and I, we have like money talks and we have sort of like, you must start a business when you're young because it gives you a sense of the value of money because like if you restrict pocket money for kids, right? It makes them think about how they spend the money. And one of two things will happen. Well, I hope the third doesn't happen. But the first thing that will happen is they either slow their spending and they live within the budget. Or they say, I've slowed it enough, but I need more. Now I need to figure out how to generate. And I think it's that thinking around it that allows them to think about what they can do to generate. So it's not that you're captive to it, but you realize the money gives you optionality on the things that you can do. And once you figure out how to generate it, then you can say, you know what? I am going to live a lifestyle of in the countryside and I need this amount of money. That's all I need. And that's what I'm going to make. And then some people will have aspirations. Like one of my kids has aspirations of a castle. So you just laid out that for you to do a castle, this is the kind of money you need. So people can figure out where they are.
And the last question we ask every guest is, who do you want to see on the Afropolitan podcast? Whose story do you think needs to be told?
Gosh, I have to think about that one. You guys are going to edit this.
While you think about it, I do have one more question.
Oh, okay.
I think you and I were having a conversation, but what I wanted to get are your thoughts around ethical wealth creation, especially in our market. Right? And I think sometimes, you know, you hear these stories, whether it's just across the ecosystem and not just the ecosystem, but just our social, economic, political situation. Right? And I think what I would love for this episode to also do is show people that ethical wealth creation is actually possible. Like if you create something and you give society what it needs but didn't yet know how to get, you get rewarded. And sometimes how you get rewarded is money. So could you speak to that as like a thesis and philosophy in how you navigate even your transactions where it's a win-win philosophy versus like a zero-sum game?
Right. On ethical wealth creation, people need to see the possible. So if what you show them is that the way to get to living the life that you want is through having funds available. And the way to get those funds available is through the political path. Then the possible for the people is that path. If you show them that the possible is, let's say, trading. So let's say you come from a trading family. You see people trading and you know that that person did really well and they were trading this and they grew up that way. Then that's the possible. I think for where we are currently, and I think Shala of Paystack has done a really good job with this, is that he's shown people the possible. Him and Ezra have done a fantastic job with Paystack. They've seen the possible of how you can build something on the technology side. And the possible is that you can be very wealthy and you can live a really good life and still be impactful in this environment. And I think more stories like those need to be told. So people are seeing the possibles, not just being Channel A. It's going to be others. So if you think about, let's say, wealth on the tech side, technology in the US is not really, hasn't really been a big source of wealth creation in terms of people's minds until you had the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
Once the dot-com boom happened and people were shown the possibles, you had investors flock to dot-com stocks. You had people that left the East Coast and moved to the West Coast to seek their fortune at dot-com companies. Imagine all the people that started in technology during the times of Altair Computer and Digital and Microsoft. They built all those companies. And it was quietly in the background. Now you look at the richest people in America. Think 70% are tech. So it's something that builds momentum, that builds in the background. People are building. And then when it finally emerges, you find that there are a significant number of people that have built wealth. So I think the stories that need to be told are those, not just of the fundings, but the sacrifice, the pain, the give-ups that you had, and then the arrival at the point. And when you arrive, it is significantly higher than where you would be elsewhere. Now, the great thing about it is not the arrival. The great thing about it is the replicability of the journey. I can't replicate being a politician. I don't know the relationships that you had in the background or the favors you had to curry. But building a company, I can replicate that across 50 entrepreneurs tomorrow. And they can replicate it as time goes on as well.
What do you say? I think I and a couple of friends were having this discussion around, I think China started to clamp down on quite a few of the social media platforms in the country. And their reasoning at the time was, and this was like a couple of years ago, was our best and brightest leaving university are going into like the TikTok type companies, the social media companies. And we need our best and brightest to be across all our sectors, driving innovation, driving change. Now, I think the U.S. is also grappling with that in a way, but obviously it's a much larger economy. We were talking more about Nigeria, where it seems our best and brightest seem to be going into maybe the tech sector or, financial services. And do you have a perspective around, not to say we put a quota on any of it, but the fact that even a lot of our best and brightest seem to be raising for financial fintech type companies, whereas we have a multitude of problems to solve for on the continent. Do you in one way or the other lean towards like China's perspective on things, where we do need our best and brightest not to be congregated in just one sector, but being able to fan out to say, yo, we have problems to solve in all these sectors. So you guys should think through all of it in a much more holistic sense.
So ideas go to where capital is.
Yeah.
And if capital is not in that sector, then ideas flee. So if you look at fintech, it's because there's an abundance of capital that people build in fintech. Now, that capital has been dictated from offshore. Now, the challenge that we have is how do you change the narrative and find ways to dictate some of that from onshore? I know the number of doctors we produce, number of lawyers, number of engineers, but I also know the number of people that go into the arts. But if you can find a way to create the capital source that supports them, then you'll find that people will be spread out across all industries. Mm-hmm. Now, the only way to get that done is you have people that have the wherewithal to be able to support them. So there's a good friend that he's Naz. His name is Naz. He's the head of Inkblot, right? And Naz was a private equity guy. And he left private equity to go do films. He loves making movies. He enjoys it. Now, he could always stay on the financial services side and done a fantastic job doing it. But because he was able to get capital and do the things he wanted to do, he was able to move to the creative side. So I think capital is the restrictor. But I don't think people should think about capital in terms of institutional large money capital. A capital is the people around you. Being able to persuade your uncle or your aunt to... Somebody pitched me this about 5 years ago. They're like, I need to make a Nollywood film. So I watched them for like a year or so. And I think the budget for him to make his film was like 20 million.
Naira.
Mm-hmm. 20 million Naira. That is a rounding error on a raise for a tech company. Tech companies are raising $500,000 earliest stage. This is somebody that wants to make a movie. So I think it's if that capital is available, then you'll see lots of great things. I follow music a lot and like music. When I was younger, I used to come to Nigeria and you'd sort of hear the songs and the production quality was off. Some things happened in 1990, the 90s. So the technology went from studios and it went into computers. So what you find is that you had like the 808 kicks, you had like Tascam boards. So you could take all that technology, put it into your bedroom and make music. And in the US, you found that rap music that would never have been produced in a studio by a record label was now being produced in a very high quality inside a bedroom. That same technology moved over to Nigeria, and suddenly the quality of music significantly went up. So I think find a way, and sometimes it's capital money, and sometimes it's just platforms that allow people to create. So the movie industry might not be, we need to find a way to fund every movie. The unlock might be, need to find a distribution mechanism so the movies that are made can find an audience so the creators can make money from it so they can make more movies. Mm. So I think it's finding the unlocks in all these different things.
And actually, speaking of Nollywood, did he tell you how much you would get return? Like what was, like you're investing 20M, what would you get back as an investor?
I'm a child of God. No, that's the way I looked at that investment. It's like the person, there's something that is infectious about people that have a passion about creating things. So you're saying to yourself, I may not get that money back, but I sure as hell would love to see what this movie comes out as. And I think those are sort of the early people that go into markets. It's belief. That's all it is. Now, you'll find that 1 in 5, 1 in 10 gets picked up and makes a lot of money. But the initial thing that drew you into it was not, I looked at the numbers and 20 million would yield me 70. Okay, so I'm getting like 3.5. Okay, sure, let's do the deal. There are people that have stories inside of them that they want to tell. And they just need your help to tell those stories, whether it's through music or through art and so on. So I collect art and I do art. And you see some people that are, you go to the studios that they run and the studios are bare and all the money has been poured into paint, into canvas, into easels. And that's what they live and breathe. So I think it's those kinds of supportive systems across, not just tech, it's being able to apply it to different sectors, whether it's the medical, education, and so on.
Okay. Well, I'm going to circle back.
A person.
Who do you want to see on that couch? Whose story?
whose story? That's a good question. You guys are going to take a 30-second break and I'll think of something. Yeah.
It could be anybody. Doesn't have to be tech. Doesn't have to be VC. It could be a friend, anyone that you think, like, they have a very interesting story and it needs to be told.
Now I'm cycling through trying to figure out who I'd want to hear their story. No, there are a lot of interesting stories. I'm just trying to figure out who.
But you can mention multiple people, too.
Multiple people. It doesn't have to be one.
No, you know, the problem with the lens that I'm looking through is I throw them in there. I'm like, I'd like to hear you. No, I don't want to hear that. Hey, I don't want to hear that. You know whose story would be interesting if he were Frank? I can't remember Paul's last name. Founder of Landmark.
Landmark, okay.
You know, I spoke to him. So, yeah, it's coming. Yeah.
No, I think it would be very interesting to hear his story because I think his story is one that would be very appropriate for people that are coming back into an environment that is as dynamic as ours is and how you recover from those things. He's a great guy. I mean, I like him a lot. But it would be great just to hear that story.
Dynamic is definitely the right words. I know you were in that law library for sure. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.